May it please the court. Good afternoon. Again, my name is Bruce Angelillo. It is a distinct professional honor every time I have the opportunity to appear before this court. I'm going to ask you today to right a wrong that comes from the decision of the Court of Chancery after trial in this case. And let me tell you what was wrong and why we think the decision below should be reversed. First of all, because in the Chancellor's words, the key question here was what was Goldman Sachs thinking when it performed its analysis for the Special Committee of Southern Peru. Since that was the question, it was clear error to bar Goldman Sachs from coming to testify at the trial to answer the very question that the Chancellor was posing.
Can you help me understand procedurally, was the witness barred? In other words, if he had shown up, would he have been allowed to testify during the scheduled trial date?
The Chancellor barred the Goldman Sachs proposed witness from appearing at trial and testifying as a trial witness. He was precluded from testifying at the trial.
Okay.
That's the first error. The second error is that the court compounds it. And the court compounds this legal error by then resorting, without that testimony, to read Goldman's mind to find that the deal was unfair. This error, or these errors, are not inconsequential or harmless. This resulted in a $2 billion judgment. Now, let me begin. The court is looking at this through the prism of Levitt versus Bouvier. And the court's review of factual findings is deferential only so long as, quote, the findings are supported by the record and the conclusions are the product of an orderly and logical deductive process. Further, this court will, quote, set aside the factual findings of the Court of Chancery if they are clearly wrong. In this case, the Chancellor sat both as judge and jury. And as fact finder, he was bound by the record that was presented. There were four fact witnesses: Luis Miguel Palomino, Harold Handelsman, Armando Ortega, and Raul Jacob. They testified uniformly about the work performed and the judgments that were made. And their testimony was unrebutted. The plaintiff did not call any fact witnesses in rebuttal, and they did not cross-examine the witnesses with respect to any of the particulars that the witnesses testified to that suggested or demonstrated that the special committee was anything other than qualified, experienced, independent, and disinterested. And the record is without without doubt a record that was unchallenged with respect to the committee hiring very fine legal advisors, very fine financial advisors, very fine mining advisors, that they met 20 times, that they met with Goldman Sachs face-to-face 14 times, and they took 8 months to consider and negotiate the transaction. I've got to just stop and pause and make the observation that notwithstanding that the Chancellor, at the end of the trial, which was piecemeal over about 3 days, concluded that the deal was unfair, and concluded that the deal was unfair because it was the product of a special committee that had a controlled mindset, and that Goldman Sachs was then subject to that controlled mindset, that 6 months before, the Chancellor, after full summary judgment briefing and argument, concluded as a matter of law that the special committee, that he could find no material question of fact that they breached their duties of good faith or loyalty. Now, when a trial court reaches a decision that cannot be supported by the record and is not the product of an orderly and logical deductive process, it must be reversed. And that's what we're asking the court to do. And if I may, I'd like to now turn to the two reasons that I first stated at the opening with respect to why this case should be reversed. First, there was no basis to exclude the proposed Goldman witness from testifying at trial. The standard of review is a judge's evidentiary rulings are reviewed for an abuse of discretion, and I'm citing Barrow versus Abramowitz. And citing the St. Francis de Sales case, quote, when improperly excluded evidence goes to the very heart of a plaintiff's case and might well have affected the outcome of the trial, the exclusion of the evidence warrants a new trial. It was an abuse of discretion to bar this witness from testifying because there was no legal basis to exclude him. Again, at summary judgment, the chancellor said that this case was, quote, about what the bankers for the committee were thinking, close quote. And as the court can tell from our appellate briefs, who are both sides' briefs, there are disputes about exactly what Goldman did and why they did it.
Did this witness that was excluded have firsthand knowledge of the events?
This witness who was excluded was part of the team that made the presentation at the time they were hired. He was not part of the deal team. He was a member of the Goldman Fairness Opinion Committee. The Goldman Fairness Opinion Committee is the committee that reviews all fairness opinions. He is the chair of the Fairness Opinion Committee. He is not Mr. Sanchez, who was the deal team leader. That being said, Your Honor, the reasons why his testimony, we believe, was key was because he would have been able to answer, as a member of the Fairness Opinion Committee and a member of the Goldman firm, he would have been able to explain the whys.
My question is, would he be talking about Goldman procedures generally, or would he be talking about this specifically? Because clearly, if he doesn't have firsthand knowledge and he's attributing things to people, there might have been hearsay objections. And if he's simply talking about the Goldman process, then I guess the logical extension would be, here's the process, and it was followed in this case. So that's my question. Was he going to give general information or specific information to this deal?
He was going to give specific information to this deal.
Was that proffer made to the trial court?
The record is that the plaintiffs objected 5 days before trial of the identification of the substitute witness. There a telephonic hearing was made. Chancellor Strine ruled orally that it was too late to proffer a substitute witness. That's the extent of the record, Your Honor.
So there's nothing in the record as to what the excluded witness would have said if allowed to testify?
There was no proffer made at the trial as to what the witness would have testified. However, Your Honor, once the chancellor ruled that he was not going to hear any Goldman witness in a case where he said at the conclusion of summary judgment that what Goldman was thinking and what the reasons why Goldman was doing what it did was key, Your Honor, respectfully, we needed to do no more. And I may also add, Your Honor, that one of the grounds, there was not a ground argued either by the plaintiff nor by the court in its ruling that producing a second best Goldman witness, because the first best Goldman witness, Your Honor, was unavailable. The plaintiff's lackadaisical prosecution in this case, 7 years after the deal, we found ourselves with the witness no longer associated with Goldman in Mexico and not willing voluntarily to travel.
Just so I understand,
yeah.
There's not an affidavit, there's not anything of record as to what this witness would have said?
No, Your Honor. There was no affidavit was put before the trial court. There was no re-argument made, effectively, to the trial court at the time of trial saying, Chancellor Strein, would you reconsider what you've just done? No, that was not done.
Would it have made any difference? And the reason I ask that question is it sounds to me like the ruling was based upon the period of time between the witness being proffered and the trial, not on the basis of the merits of what the witness might or might not have testified to. Is that incorrect?
No, Justice Steele, you are exactly right. It was never an issue as to the relevance of the testimony. The entire basis upon which the witness was excluded was it was late. And Your Honor,
we turn to that for a moment?
Sure.
Because it just, as a matter of kind of common sense, if a specific Goldman Sachs witness is one of the key witnesses for your side, wouldn't you have known that there was an issue with his unwillingness to appear somewhat more in advance than 7 days or 8 days before trial?
Justice Berger, as the court is aware, I was not trial counsel. But as the record, as you have it, it indicates that the witness, Mr. Sanchez, was deposed in 2009. And it was not until the eve of trial that he expressed the view that he would not be willing to come.
Do I understand the record correctly? He indicated he wouldn't be willing to come, although his deposition was presented. And you wanted to present another Goldman witness, but along with your application was a representation that the trial date couldn't be held, that you need to extend the trial date. Now, I understand there's a debate about whether the trial date would have been moved anyway, but wasn't it a combined request? We don't have a witness. We have a substitute witness. But we can't keep the trial date if we use our substitute witness. Is that correct?
We are both at a slight disadvantage, Justice Holland, in that I was not trial counsel. But my best understanding of the record is that the proposal was that this witness, in order to be deposed and to testify, would be presented out of order, and the possibility that he would have to appear on an additional trial day, which at the time Chancellor Strein, given the collateral unrelated circumstances of his elevation to becoming chancellor, had fit this trial in bits and pieces and said that because of his own scheduling constraints that they would add another day if that was necessary. Now, but to answer Justice Berger's question, complete my answer to Justice Berger's question, it is never the case that admissible evidence, which could be presented by a witness, that the identification of the witness late in the day is a basis to exclude the testimony. Moreover,
my question was not whether that's a basis for excluding the testimony, but rather what was going on. It's hard to imagine that Mr. Sanchez notified you he wouldn't come to the trial 8 days before trial. One would expect that there would have been back and forth going back months before the trial, and I'm trying to figure out whether something happened right at the last minute so that you were all moving along thinking Mr. Sanchez is coming and then he had a heart attack or he, you know, something else happened.
Your Honor, it has never been the contention by anyone in the case that defense counsel or the defendants sort of hid in the weeds about this and then didn't disclose it till late in the day. That is not, no one has suggested that, and to the best of my knowledge, that is not the case. Now, let's just say, for sake of argument, Your Honor, let's just say that it posit as a hypothetical that there was tardiness in disclosing that we had learned that Mr. Sanchez had decided he wasn't going to come. Even if that were the case, I must say to Your Honors that Chancery Court Rule 16 is the Court of Chancery Rule 16 is the rule which applies to this situation.
Okay.
That is to say,
but let me stop you there.
Yeah.
You agree that we're reviewing this particular ruling on an abuse of discretion standard, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And when you try to figure out whether another person or another judge abused his discretion, you'd like to know what the relevant facts were. And if I were still on the Court of Chancery and I was told relatively at the last minute that there would be a substitution, I would be asking questions, or if not asking questions, I would be hoping to hear that something out of the ordinary, something unexpected had happened, because of course you were preparing for trial for months now and you've just now learned that somebody that was a critical witness is not going to be available.
That's, to the best of my knowledge, what happened. He did not work any longer for Goldman Sachs. The best of our knowledge, he consulted with his new employer. His new employer said, why are you bothering to go up to New York, up to Wilmington, Delaware, to sit for a trial? You don't work for Goldman Sachs. And he said he wasn't going to show up. Now, Your Honor, in the context of reviewing for abuse of discretion, where the transaction was announced in 2004, the litigation was commenced in 2004, the deal closed in March 2005, and they don't prosecute a case, and two vice chancellors have to reprimand them, and they have to confess after years and years and years of inaction, that when finally the chancellor forces a trial in this case, forces one, and my clients have to come and defend themselves, 7 years later, an investment banker who worked for the special committee, who was dismissed from the case, says he won't come from Mexico City. It is an abuse of discretion when I put forward a substitute Goldman Sachs witness to talk about and explain the 14 different written presentations and answer the questions that Chancellor Strein lays out in 105 pages of an opinion. That's the reason why this is wrong. And Rule 16 of the rules say that we didn't have to identify the trial witnesses until the pretrial order was prepared, and we did include Mr. Del Favro. And if the plaintiff wanted to know about Mr. Del Favro earlier or wanted to make the argument, they should have served, as everyone knows, interrogatories. So the notion that lateness precludes us from producing the witness to address the key issues in the case is frankly inexplicable, or inexplicable. Your Honor, what Chancellor Strein said at that hearing when he barred the witness was, he said, tell me why I should be hearing a new witness at this stage just because an investment banker has chosen not to come and testify in a trial involving his work. You know, and I might say 7 years later. All right? Chancellor Strein answered his own question in his opinion when he says that the reason he's in this dilemma where he is imagining and speculating about what Goldman did, he says the record suffers from issues, including the absence of a Goldman Sachs trial witness. And he then says, and it should be properly laid, quote, at the plaintiff's door. How you can bar me from calling a Goldman witness and then write a 105-page opinion.
Were you barred from taking a trial deposition, a deposition for use at trial?
Our understanding was we were barred from putting in directly or indirectly any testimony from anyone from Goldman Sachs.
Well, you knew the trial dates in advance of the pretrial conference, correct?
That's correct.
And you knew your witness was unavailable during those trial dates?
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm not following. Which witness are we talking about?
The one that it was excluded. That
you yes.
Knew. You knew he was not available during those trial dates? Or not?
No, I believe he was available, but the issue was in order to give the plaintiff an opportunity to take a deposition before he testified. That's what I believe was the case.
So you could have produced him at trial.
I could have produced him at trial.
As a live witness.
Right. But I also, you know, Your Honor, I also, another part of the argument, which I just have to sort of emphasize, what was the magic of these trial dates? What, after 7 years, was the magic of one day followed by three mornings? What's the magic? If given the magnitude of this case, given the prejudice we were suffering by having to defend it 7 years later, where we say we have a witness, we want to call, and it causes an adjustment to the trial schedule, what's the magic of those dates? It's a bench trial. This is not an injunction. Nothing's going to happen after all this time. That's what's fundamentally wrong. Now, in the small amount of time that I have remaining, I'd like to talk.
Well, you're into your rebuttal time. You understand?
Oh, I'm sorry. Then, Your Honor, I think I'm going to sit down. Thank you.
May it please the court. On behalf of the nominal defendant, Southern Copper Corporation, I would like to briefly address the issue of attorney's fees in this case. As the court is aware, the court below awarded plaintiff's counsel a fee in excess of $300 million. We believe that is by far the largest fee awarded in Delaware history. The amount comes to $35,000 per hour, which is the highest effective hourly rate in any case, anywhere, of which we are aware. We submit that in awarding this fee, the court below committed three interrelated legal errors that led to an abuse of discretion. First, although the court discussed all of the Sugar Land factors, in fact, its analysis looks almost exclusively at the benefit to the corporation. The court did not look deeply at factors such as the effort expended in this case. And we know here that counsel had previously been severely criticized by the court for delay, or how the implied hourly rate compared to other cases. Why, for example, was the effort here worth an hourly rate 10 times that in other cases in which substantial fees were awarded? Indeed, the highest rate of which we are aware, effective hourly rate, in any other Delaware case is $4,700 an hour. Second, the court explicitly rejected those chancery decisions that had previously held that the court had a duty to prevent attorneys from receiving a windfall. And it also rejected, we think, the declining percentage approach that had been supported by 30 years of chancery precedent, and which we believe also received at least a favorable nod from this court in Goodrich versus E.F. Hutton. Finally, we believe that the court below awarded a reasonable fee in violation of Rule 5.1A. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to ask you a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
I thought you referred in your brief that the percentage should be a single digit?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what's the range that you're suggesting it should be?
Well, Your Honor, my suggestion on this would be to look at all the factors in coming up with that decision. I believe you need to look at the effort expended, the hours expended, what has been awarded in other cases. As in our view, Your Honor, it should be no more than approximately an award in the lower tens of millions of dollars. We're saying here that the important thing is to look at everything together, not to just look at you get X percent, but to apply all the Sugar Land factors together and realize that in this case, it did not take the effort of a Smith versus Van Gorkum, a Sugar Land, and to award an appropriate fee
Well, the Second Circuit refers to anything over $100 million as a mega case. Is that your position, that we should sort of set a mega case rule for single digits?
No, I think, Your Honor, there has been a declining percentage approach applied by this court, well, at least applied by the Chancery Court. I think this court, as I said, nodded and said, yes, that's correct. But in Sugar Land, the court said, the Chancery Court said, I award a fee of X and it's capped here. In the Shell case, Shell appraisal, Vice Chancellor Hartnett gave about, I guess, 7%. He gave, I think, $15 million and said explicitly, there was hundreds of millions awarded there. Explicitly, it has to, the number has to go down as the case gets bigger. But of course, one would need also to look at how many hours. This was 8,700 hours, not small, but not huge by any means. How much effort went into getting in that? And we think that the court below, in focusing and saying, well, investment bankers and hedge funds get big percentages, why not lawyers? We think it missed the essence of Sugar Land. You look at all the factors to find a reasonable fee that must be reasonable under 1.5, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, good afternoon, Your Honors. Let me talk about the Goldman witness. It's a frustrating argument because it's based on a complete factual, I'll say misunderstanding, because counsel here wasn't trial counsel. First, let me talk about, obviously, this is an abuse of discretion issue, so the question is whether the decision was based on conscience and reason or whether it was arbitrary and capricious. Let me start with what's in the record with respect to Goldman Sachs. Because when you read their brief, they make it sound like there's something missed. There's a big, huge hole with respect to evidence about what Goldman Sachs did in this case. The head Goldman Sachs banker, Mr. Sanchez, who was in charge of this engagement, was deposed. Everyone knew, and he had already left Goldman Sachs in 2006. Everyone knew that we couldn't force him to appear at trial, so we had a videotaped deposition that we were prepared to use at trial, which is not uncommon in Chancery Court cases to submit, you know, witness testimony by deposition, and now we do it by videotape. And so he was deposed, and interestingly, the defendants actually asked questions after we questioned the witness. So both sides were kind of aware that this might be it for this guy because we can't force him to come to trial. So the actual written transcript and the video was admitted into the trial record. So there is a Goldman witness testimony at trial. And obviously, all Goldman Sachs documents, boxes and boxes were produced. Everyone had a chance to go through them, and nobody was prevented from putting in any documents. You know, everyone put in whatever Goldman Sachs documents they wanted to into the trial record.
Let me ask you a question that's a product of being perhaps too many years away from the litigation. There was a time when, if you put the other party on notice that you wished to take their witness's deposition, you were to tell them in advance whether it was for discovery or whether it was for trial. And the parties reacted differently at the deposition based upon the reason for which the deposition was noticed. The deposition of Mr. Sanchez, was it noticed as discovery or was it noticed as a trial deposition, or does that make any difference now in Chancery?
Well, Your Honor, I've been doing it for 23 years, so obviously everyone here has been doing it a lot longer. That's actually the first time anyone ever said that to me. I am not even sure there was a notice of deposition. I mean, it's kind of informal. We're working with counsel who we're familiar with, and we're just setting dates for the different witnesses. I believe we did a 30B6 designation and asked for a whole bunch of Goldman people, and Mr. Stone came back to us and said, here's the guy. This is the lead guy. He knows everything. He's the guy we're going to give you.
Okay, well, that means, are you telling me that the practice, as you understand it, for the last 23 years, which, of course, is now 1 year shorter than when I did it last, so 24 years ago is my recollection. You're telling me now that there is no magic in that designation, that all parties should be aware that a deposition that appears to be taken for discovery could be used at trial and all parties would have an expectation that could happen.
That's how it's been done in every case I've done for 23 years.
Right.
But one important thing is this whole argument has to lead to something. It has to lead to there's something missing, right? And the defendants conceded below, and this is significant, in their post-trial brief, quote, "The record here is replete with evidence showing what Goldman Sachs did and why," unquote. Now they're saying there's something missing? I mean, and I'll tell you, it's important to understand the context of that, because one of our arguments below was to the chancellor, you ought to draw some negative inferences here, because this, the lead guy at Goldman, he's not coming. And they don't normally do that. They're usually willing to come and defend what they did. And because it was ridiculous what they did, and I can get into, you know, how it was sort of covered up and how they, it was a sleight of hand in connection with their board books and the showings of, you know, the analyses. But, you know, we said that, and their response was, what? There's the record is voluminous. It's, there's plenty in the record to explain exactly what Goldman Sachs did. So the argument they're making now, there's something important missing? I mean, it's just flatly contradicted what they said below. And they didn't just say that. They said in their post-trial brief that, quote, "the absence of a Goldman Sachs witness, the argument that, quote, the absence of a Goldman Sachs witness left critical questions unanswered is nonsense." Now they're saying the opposite. Now let me talk about, quickly turn to the facts relating to this, the quote, excluded witness.
Well, I'd like you to explain what is the legal basis that allows the court to exclude a witness when there's no scheduling order, discovery violation involved.
Well, the court didn't exclude the witness. And like you, as Your Honor said, they could have taken his deposition and introduced him in the trial. And we'd actually, you know, they had identified another surprise witness, and they said, here he is for deposition, and we deposed him, he testified at trial. What happened here was the defendants came in and said, there's an email chain, and this is all laid out, all the facts are laid out in detail in our briefs, because the factual basis for this argument is incorrect. But sort of right before trial, the defendants seemed to have an interest in having a live Goldman witness. And they were said they might get this guy and they might get that guy. And then we got an email a few days before trial, and it's all in the record, saying we're not going to have a live Goldman witness. And then some point a few days after that, we get an email, you know, or proposal to the court. We have a guy. We've located a guy at Goldman. We want him to testify. He cannot appear at the trial. They didn't ask for the trial to be rescheduled. They said, our proposal is, well, let's have the trial. We want to have the trial. And about a month after the trial, the plaintiffs, he'll be available. The plaintiffs can take his deposition. And then at some point after that, well, let's bring him back and have another day of trial. And our argument was, you know, we have a couple different arguments, but the first argument was, that's not fair. I mean, we can't depose a guy after your whole...
So you did not oppose him appearing to testify. Assuming they had sent down a private jet, brought him back during the scheduled trial date, you would have had no opposition to that.
Well, except we never got to the... We did object to that, Your Honor. Let me explain that in a little more detail. That requires a little explanation. Mr. Del Favro, we had no idea what he knew, and they never said what it is that he was going to testify. There was no proffer in this case at the trial level, and there isn't one now. What was he going to say?
Well, the trial date's a discovery cutoff date in itself, isn't it?
It sure is, and, you know, so this process they were proposing, I mean, it's hard to fathom that it's an abuse of discretion to say, I reject your proposal to have this deposition after the trial and hold the trial open. I mean, you know, so I don't think the chancellor actually said he couldn't come to trial. All he said was, your proposal to do it this way, we're not going to do it. That's unfair to the plaintiffs, that you get, they take a deposition after the case goes in, and then you bring a guy in to sweep up the case if there's a problem with it. But it, you know, one key point was, you know, they never really said what Del Favro was going to testify to. He wasn't part of the team. He didn't work on the engagement. I mean, he went to one special committee meeting, which was the meeting to pitch, where Goldman pitched its services.
Had you directed an interrogatory asking them to identify the experts, the substance of their testimony, and the basis for their testimony?
Yes, an expert, and they weren't offering him as an expert witness, they were offering him as a fact witness. And one of our arguments to the chancellor, and it was sort of in the in brief letters and at the pretrial conference was...
Well, was there a fact witness interrogatory?
You know, it was handled, it wasn't, there was not, I don't believe. It was handled informally. We said, we were talking to Morris Nichols saying, you know, who's...
So there's no discovery which people violation? Are
you, I don't think there was a discovery violation by this, I'll say that. But they never said what Del Favro was going to testify to. He didn't attend any meetings. We speculated and said to the chancellor, you know, we're guessing that what he's going to testify to is Goldman's general practices, because that's really all he knew. He was on this opinion committee that oversaw all the opinions. And we pointed out that, you know, we did try to ask Mr. Sanchez questions that went beyond what he did in this case and what the practices were, and we were blocked. And again, that's all cited and reviewed in the briefs that, you know, they said, these are fact witnesses. You can ask them what they did in connection with this transaction, and that's it. And so what was, you know, to me, Your Honor, if you're going to come in and say it's an abuse of discretion to use this procedure, you know, not use this procedure where we hold the trial open and have a witness test, you know, depose and testify after the fact, there had to be a proffer at the time. Here's what he was going to say, and here's why it would have mattered, especially since they've admitted in their briefs the record with respect to what Goldman Sachs did was complete. I mean, isn't that the end of the argument? I mean, to me it is. This is sort of, it wasn't really a big issue. This is something that was the appellate lawyers just came up with. I mean, there's if you look at the opinion, this argument is focused on the concept that what Goldman Sachs, their analysis, understanding it is very important. Well, their expert witness did the exact same thing that Goldman Sachs did, as the chancellor explained. I mean, everyone, we all understood exactly what Goldman Sachs did. I mean, there's no issue here that the chancellor didn't understand what they did. What they did was, and I'm lapsing into some of the other arguments now that weren't addressed, which I was always told not to do, but, you know, this case was all about this term, relative valuation, because let me back up here. The transaction at issue here was the purchase by Southern Copper of a company, Minera Mexico, from Southern Copper's controlling shareholder, and the consideration they paid was stock. And so our expert testified the way to assess the fairness of this transaction is we know what that stock is worth. It's New York Stock Exchange stock from a large company that has more than a million shares trading every week, and it's worth, you know, it's over $3 billion. And the trial testimony from the defendants was we could have gotten that's what it was worth. They admitted that. And so the issue, our experts said, you know, the issue is what's the value of what you're buying. And both experts did, you know, discounted cash flow valuations, primarily to a lesser extent comparable company valuations, and both came up with values of about $2 billion for what was being bought. And actually the committee, when the first proposal was made, the testimony was, well, we looked at it and it was way off. It didn't look fair. So Mr. Handelsman testified, and this is all detailed in the opinion, he went to Goldman and said, why don't you do a discounted cash flow valuation of our company? And they did that, and it came up to half the market value. And so they said it's fair. And it's the most bizarre set of circumstances I've ever seen. If you look at the final Goldman Sachs board presentation book, I defy you to look at it and tell what it is they're doing. It doesn't say in here, what we've done is a discounted cash flow valuation of both companies. One, it's $2 billion, more or less, $2 to $2.4 billion for the... what the chancellor called the get, and it's about, you know, two or whatever for the give, and that is half the market price of the stock. So anyway, we all understood what was happening, and they then had an expert come in and sort of regurgitate what Goldman Sachs did, and he testified about this relative valuation issue at trial. So there's nothing in the record that's missing. There's no question that the chancellor didn't understand what was going on. he, in fact, did understand exactly what was going on, as reflected in a 105-page opinion. And I always understood abuse of discretion standard of review to be, it's not whether different judges would have decided things differently. It's that, you know, the appellate court looks at it and says, was this a reasoned, thoughtful process where conscience and reason was applied, or was it some arbitrary and capricious thing? And if you look at a 105-page opinion with 206 footnotes, with extensive cites to the and quotes from the trial transcript, depositions and documents, but obviously there's reason and conscience applied to this. So, you know, most of their arguments go to the or just fail flat out on the basic abuse of discretion level standard of review.
Tell us in the final analysis how you'd characterize the chancellor's ruling on not hearing from the witness. Is he saying what the witness has to say is not relevant? What we've done in discovery is enough? The witness is too late? Or we're not going to redo the whole trial schedule to accommodate your witness?
I think all he said, Your Honor, and I think it's pretty clear from the transcript, was what you've proposed, defendants, is not fair. I'm not going to allow that, which was to have a guy be deposed after the trial's over and then bring him back at some point after that. That was not allowed. Like I said, you know,
so that's what we're looking at when we're looking at the exercise of discretion. Should we allow a witness to testify after all the evidence is otherwise closed, although you would be permitted to depose him? And to the extent the chancellor said, we're not going to do it that way, that's the only ruling. So we don't have any fallback ruling on, all right, well, if we can't do it that way, can we work him into the trial dates you already have available? So the only exercise of discretion we're looking at is their proposal. Is that correct?
That is my argument. I mean, that was what was set before the chancellor. I mean, that was the issue he decided. Now, I think you can also say this argument also fails because there was never a specific proffer. You can't argue abuse of discretion unless you can show here's what he would have, you know, here's what we're saying he would have testified to, and here's why it's important. I mean, what is it? Does anybody know what he was, you know, why it's important? What was he going to say? I mean, they've already admitted the record was replete.
Well, aren't they saying that he was going to answer the chancellor's questions, whatever they may have
been? And the chancellor specifically said, in the transcript, if you thought, you know, if you're bringing him because you think I need him to answer questions, that's not correct. I'll watch the videotape. I mean, answers questions about what? You know, about this case? He didn't know anything about what Goldman Sachs did. He didn't participate in it. So let me briefly talk about the other issue, the fee. Obviously, there's other arguments that everyone's left to the briefs, and we will too. We submit the fee determination of the chancellor here is controlled by the recent decision, of course, recent decision in the EMAC Worldwide case. The chancellor unquestionably applied the Sugarland test, admittedly went through all the factors, balanced them, and concluded that a 15% of the recovery here, inclusive of expenses, was an appropriate compensation.
Well, I know he did that, but you agree this is a mega case with a recovery in excess of $100 million? That's what the Second Circuit refers to.
Yes, and it's not our understanding that this court's ever adopted, you know, set forth a rule or changed Sugarland depending on the size of the judgment. I mean, the Sugarland test applies, and the court took into account that it's bigger and reduced the fee. From, you know, normally, you know, if you try a big corporate case and get a good recovery and it's appealed and you take it to the very end, you know, 25 to 33% is the normal range. He departed significantly downward from that here.
Is it accurate that in looking at other mega cases that it's usually a single digit that is used as a percentage?
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. Okay. I think It's the evolving trend, and this was really briefed, addressed somewhat in the briefs below. We didn't get into it here because of the abuse of discretion standard of review. But the emerging trend is not to reduce it, it's to increase it, because you completely diverge the interests of the lawyer and the client if you have a declining percentage. Because you don't want to say, if you get $100 million, you get 30%. But if you get $200 million, you get something less. So you're encouraging lawyers that are taking these cases on a contingent basis from trying to get the big number. If you're going to get paid the same thing for a $100 million settlement as you are for a $300 million judgment, what's your incentive to take the case to trial? I mean, I thought the rule here was, if you put $1 million of your firm's money at stake with 11 partners and spend 8,000 hours, go around the world taking depositions and get the biggest recovery ever, not by a little bit, but by a factor of like 20. I mean, the biggest case we could find was fairly recently the AIG case. It was about $120 million settlement. It was also another $90 million settlement. And they got 22.5% there. This case is basically 20 times bigger, and it was obtained by judgment, hard-fought judgment. And it's not just a big recovery because it's a big case. I mean, the relative size of the recovery to the transaction is unprecedented. I mean, the value of what was bought, the chancellor found to be around $2.4 billion, and they paid $3.7 billion. They paid 50% more than it was worth. And to convince him to make those findings, we had to show that what one of the world's preeminent investment bankers did was completely misguided, and top lawyers were misguided. And to convince him that effectively what the special committee did, which is in fact what was found here, was to not negotiate, but was to engage in a process of trying to rationalize why this was fair, which is exactly what happened here. It's kind of awful to come up here and have to sort of toot your own horn and say we did a great job, but that's the position I'm in, and we think this case clearly represents the greatest recovery in total in a shareholder class or derivatives litigation in Delaware history, and really does show the utility of class and shareholder litigation. And you know, we've got lawyers who, a couple relatively small firms who went all the way. You know, we searched and tried to hire the preeminent natural resource investment banker who cost a lot of money, and we paid all his bills, and you know, we would have gotten nothing if we lost. And it was a risky case. It was a case the defendants basically thought we had no chance to win ever. As far as I know, that's what was communicated to me. So, you know, in that circumstance, is it arbitrary and capricious to say these lawyers ought to get 15% of it? I don't think you can say it is. Now, obviously, they say, but it's $35,000 an hour. Well, I never understood, you know, there's always usually in the opinions on fees a reference to what does this translate to per hour. I mean, I think it kind of breaks down when you get to after trial in an entire fairness case, and they say we didn't put in much effort. I mean, it was a lot of effort. We worked hard and put in a huge amount of effort and a huge amount of expense and had a huge amount of risk. And as the chancellor said, you know, we were asking for a lot of money, and he was very skeptical. He was skeptical going into summary judgment. He told us that. He was skeptical going into the trial. He was skeptical after the first witness, which is something he told us. And he, in the end, he explained that the fee ruling, these lawyers really brought me around. They got me to focus and understand and explain this. So I think, you know, in that respect, to say it's a windfall, I mean, a windfall is something you didn't do anything to get. I mean, we litigated a huge case and got an unprecedented result. And it's an extraordinarily large fee, and we're humbled by it. But we think, you know, we think it's fair compensation. And really, again, I think this court's role is
not to say, well, gee, what would we have awarded if we were doing it? It's to look, as all the fee rulings of this court reflect, look to see that he applied the Sugar Land factors, considered each of them, and made a reasoned determination here. He didn't give us what we were asking for. Our argument was, in the second and third biggest cases ever, they got 22.5%, and they didn't even try it. And we tried it. Why should we get less than that? Basically was the argument. And he rejected that. He took into account that he felt there was some inappropriate delay leading into the case, which I would love to get into, but my time is up, is almost up. So, you know, under the abuse of discretion standard of review, our contention is the chancellor, it's obvious from his bench ruling that he applied conscious and reason. This wasn't some arbitrary picking a number. I mean, he looked at other cases, considered the effort. He specifically talked about the particular usefulness of things that we had done in the case. And obviously, they say, well, all he really was focusing on was the benefit conferred. Well, it is the biggest, it's supposed to be the biggest factor, and you're talking about a benefit so far beyond any other benefit obtained in any chancery court or any, you know, Delaware shareholder class or derivative case, that it does call for a fee that's not comparable to the fees awarded in any other case. Unless you have any, want me to ask any questions, my time's up.
If we do, we'll ask them.
Thank you, Your Honor. For the reasons I explained, the ruling of the Court of Chancery should be affirmed. Thank you.
May it please the Court, in my limited amount of time remaining, let me just address again the Goldman witness in response to counsel's comments. What we heard is that counsel has not identified any legal basis for excluding Del Favro's testimony. None. There is no legal requirement for a proffer after the court ruled against me. There's, with respect to the deposition question, yes, they served formal notices of deposition. With respect to his point about, well, why didn't you make a bigger deposition record with Mr. Sanchez? The problem was,
as I understand, the proposal that the chancellor was ruling upon, according to the other side, was to essentially interrupt the trial, allow a deposition, and then resume the trial at a later time for other than when it had been scheduled. Is that the proposal that was ruled upon?
I do not believe that accurately represents the proposal at the time. But that being said, let's just take that at face value. All right. What the court ruled on, however, and the ruling is quoted in our briefs, the ruling is it's just that you identified him too late, not that it would adjust the trial schedule. It's just that he's too late. Now, with respect to the deposition of Mr. Sanchez in 2009, several years before the trial, the argument is you should ask more questions. The problem with that is it wasn't until December of 2010 that Chancellor Strein identified the questions that he was interested in. The problem with excluding this witness from the trial is that he could have answered those questions. Chancellor Strein could have disregarded it, but we were entitled to put a witness on to answer those questions. Fundamentally, if you wait 7 years, to borrow Chancellor Strein's analogy, 7 years to taste the bread, don't blame the ingredients. And if you're going to do that, you got to at least let the baker come into court and explain the recipe. You got to do that. That's why this case should be reversed. I also believe,
counsel, have you answered Justice Risley's question, do you think? Because your time is up.
Justice Risley, we were not conditioning the production of this witness only on requiring that the entire trial schedule could get would have to be changed. I further submit that even if that had been the case, 7 years after the fact, in a bench trial that was being fit in piecemeal over several days, then an adjustment of a week or a month or 2 months was without any consequence. And even if that was the condition upon which we were making this request, it was an abuse of discretion not to adjourn the trial for several weeks or a month or whatever it was going to do. That
fundamentally is an error of law. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel, for the argument. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.